Okay, here comes the beginning.
Hello, my name is Pat Kirschlin. We're here tonight with Lyndon LaRouche, the presidential candidate of the U.S. Labor Party.
Good evening.
Good evening.
You said after the last presidential debate that if you had been there, you could have won the debate, you could have won the election hands down in a single night. What are the issues that you could address that were ignored or basically ignored by Carter and Ford?
Well, there are two fundamental issues facing the nation and actually the world at this time, neither of which was directly addressed, have not been addressed in terms of the average.
I'll just say, he, as he's talking with his bow tie, he's looking at his fingernails like a fop. You know, he's sort of just looking and deciding whether to bite his fingernails, you know, which is a rather non-professional-looking gesture. What the fuck?
First, now, first, during the debate, in terms of the average voter would understand, by most thermonuclear war than we've ever been in our nation's life. In fact, people thought it was closer than it actually was at that point. But since the 1973, we've been edging closer and closer to the thermonuclear war. Now, Ford in the past has referred to, during the primary campaign, Ronald Reagan made an impassioned...
Okay, I'm going to the end. This is too irritating.
Would be television advertising or television coverage. That if the voter sees, and that relates to your first question, if the voter has a chance to see what we have to present in the same medium that he sees Carter and Ford, then seeing it on an authoritative medium will cause him to respond to what his preference is. Whereas if he doesn't see the campaign on his medium, on the TV, the voter is going to stay away from the polls, particularly our voters, and which means we would converge down to the 10% expectation. But if the matching funds thing is cleared, having the spots, that sort of thing, then I think we have a real shot to bring forward our potential vote. And at the same time, by the impact of our vote in the election, to shape the shaping of the policies that anyone will have to follow in this period.
Okay, you are a Marxist, contributed considerably in theoretical to the subject of Marxian economics, etc. And you're proposing a program which is basically one that would put the capitalist economy, capitalist industrialist economy, on its feet.
I'm going to go back to where he says he's a Marxist.
I think that these people, together with most Democrats, will accept the International Development Bank proposal and things like it, at least a minimal amount of it, of our program. So that it is possible, provided that Ford is forced to dump Kissinger, to dump Levy, to dump Simon's policies and so forth, and get back with the mainstream Republicans and with Democrats like if Ford goes with them, then I think the United States would pick up at least the most essential features of the policies that I would introduce, and we would at least survive. We might not have a good result, but we would be safe, and we would be coming out of the Depression, and we could fight it out from there.
Okay, in order to have someone like Ford is the obvious person in line for this, to move to support in one form or another the proposals you've outlined, and certainly in order to get you elected, would require a considerable mobilization of public opinion and support around your campaign. What kind of support do you have around the country? what kind of a machine does the Labour Party have?
We have enough support now that under certain conditions, we could get up to 30% of the vote. We have a potential which runs about 33-35%. That's social Republicans, though they have no
problem. I'm taking it back.
Stop the problems.
Ends of, I think, very, very desirable solutions that you've outlined.
We have two ways we can get it. If I were White House to establish a new monetary system, we've determined recently that the Comecon, the Soviets, and others would accept such an alternative if offered by the United States and other nations. It's no problem. The alternative, then, is could either of the other two candidates, major party candidates, handle it, such as Carter or Ford? Well, Carter's out for the United States with Carter in. But there's a question mark on Ford. If Ford were to return...
Looking for the Marxist line.
The Humphrey-Hawkins bill is consciously modeled on the Nazi labor service legislation introduced during the period 1933 to 1936. What, in general, the employment perspectives of the Democratic platform are to create not productive jobs, but to create low-wage, labor-intensive, leaf-raking jobs or make-work jobs as a substitute for unemployment compensation and welfare. That's the basic thrust. It's a program which aims at deindustrializing the United States. They propose to strip the Middle West, or industrial Middle West, of its basic industry. They propose to strip New England of its electronics and related industries, that sort of thing, to return the United States to what they see as a lower energy requiring, more primitive condition with less emphasis on technology. Such a program could only result in genocide in this country and others. Our ability to maintain our environment, our ability to meet our needs, increasing technology, in the application of technology in industry and in agriculture. The Republican platform, in contrast to the Democrats, shows what the difference is. The Republicans, though they have no program to solve the problems, have an approach which is the traditional American approach. They're committed to technological development, to industrial development, and to agricultural development as the way of providing jobs. The Democrats are, at least as far as the program is concerned, and Carter's back is concerned, though I think the average Democrat in this country thinks differently, is committed to de-emphasizing industry, de-emphasizing agricultural development, de-emphasizing technology, using labor-intensive, low-wage employment. And essentially the same form that the Hitler regime in the 33-36 period.
Okay. Very strongly that we're in a very, the United States is in a very, very serious situation with a economic collapse and nuclear war. How do we get from that point, the point we're at now, to the kinds of I think, very, very desirable solutions that you've outlined?
We have two ways we can get it. If I were president, no problem. That the work we've done with the developing sector, the work we've done directly with political factions and governments abroad in Europe and so forth.
Okay, in order to have someone like Ford is the obvious person in line for this.
Seeing it on an authoritative medium would cause him to respond to what his preference is. At the same time, by the impact of our vote in the election, to shape, contribute to the shaping of the policies that anyone will have to follow in this period.
Okay, you are a Marxist. Contributed considerably in theoretically to the subject of Marxian economics, etc. And you're proposing a program which is basically one that would put a capitalist economy, capitalist industrialist economy, on its feet. Is there any dichotomy between those two, and how would you, and how would you respond to a voter who's very interested in the kinds of proposals you're making, but has thoughts about what it means for a socialist or a Marxist to be president?
Well, as you know, as this situation developed, my attention turned frequently to the role of Karl Marx during the early 1960s. In the case of the 1860s, the case of the American Civil War, in which Marx and associates in the United States, such as Weidemeyer and others, were among the leaders in the Republican Party at that point, or the Republican Party's effort at that point, to save the Union, to save the United States from being shattered into a collection of nations ruled essentially by England. We're in the same boat today, in large measure, et cetera, et cetera. They have a policy. Their policy is essentially that I referred to. It's the Rockefeller policy. It's a policy developed largely by the Brookings Institution, though other people have been involved in it, which is based on their perception of the successful aspects of the Hitler regime of the 1933-1936 period. For example, the Democratic Party is committed to a bill called the Humphrey-Hawkins Bill. The Humphrey-Hawkins Bill is consciously modeled on the Nazi labor service jobs, or make...
I can't find the part where he says he's a Marxist. It will do it another time.
Okay.
It's already been said he's a Marxist because the guy says, as a Marxist, what do you say? But I'm trying to find the part where he kind of defines... I wonder if it's further back. Just I'll jump around another point here.
Send me that link and maybe I'll go and... Why don't you send me that link and then maybe I'll go through it and I'll excerpt the bits and have them organized.
I posted it.
Oh, okay.
It's just below P-Funk. P-Funk's latest rantings about me. P-Funk, a fucking coward. Who the hell is P-Funk? Come on. Get on the phone here. Lay out your shit. Let's see.
I like that. I did like the bit where he says, LaRouche laying out Trump's basic premise?
Yeah.
He's saying this is going to, well, except it's before it happens, right? And in 1976, things are being deindustrialized. I was living in Cleveland at that time, and they still had steel smelters because I remember I was working late one night at, it was 5 o'clock in the morning, and I walked out of the studio, out of the office building to get some air. There wasn't much air out there. It was mainly, the smell of coming from the steel smelters, overnight, creeping into the city. And it was really overwhelming. I think they were all gone within a few years.
Yeah.
And so basically, LaRouche is explaining the deindustrialization of America as he predicted it, right?
Yeah.
He saw that what their plans were.
Yeah.
The analysis in LaRouche's material is excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'll see. It's probably good it's screwed up so that you can look at it, and you being a sort of a Marxist or something, mm-hmm. I'd be interested in what you find interesting in it. So you saw the link.
Interesting. Yes, I'm just checking it now.
He starts, quote, panicking about what's going to be done in August 71. He's right out of the chute about Nixon taking the exchange rate, making the floating exchange rate in August 1571. That's what LaRouche is really uptight about. And he debates a local economist, a professor, and the LaRouche say he won the debate and embarrassed the professor, and then the Rockefeller and his goons went after LaRouche from that point on. So LaRouche was on the defensive, but, he kept saying this basic program. You're going to hear what he says then. He says today, still the same program. It's like Marxism with a human face or something. And he says, we're in a capitalist environment, so you got to deal with, he says, you got to take industrialists, farmers, and union people. Bring them together, the U.S. Labor Party, and kick out the control of the economy from Wall Street. So the Marxist tries to get rid of the capitalist, so it's sort of anti-capitalist. But he works within capitalist mechanisms of the government issuing credit to worthy projects, and there shouldn't be any real major debt.
Right.
And nor austerity conditions. And he's been, it's interesting reading how he started off with that, and then how he's managed to garble, complicate, and restate the same program in words that you, takes a while to figure out what he means. All the time, more and more promoting, classical music, Platonic dialogue, and a whole culture program he has.
Yeah.
So like Bert says, they are journalists, they're historians, he's just got these kids, baby boomers working for him for decades. They really have found a lot of documentation that's very interesting. Like Roxy, who took Marx in Berlin University, studied Heidegger or, you know, Nietzsche and Marx and all that stuff in the Berlin curriculum. Yeah. She started to read one of the LaRouche's books, a guy named Alan Salisbury, about the American Civil War. And she says to me, holy shit, Marx, correspondent with the New York Times for 10 years, or was a columnist. Like, she was blown away.
Yeah.
And like, she said, they never told me that in school, you know?
Right.
And I checked my book and my copy, and it's the New York Tribune, not the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
But there's someone who's well-educated in that world, and she says the book is amazing, all the different details. You really got a real education from it. So that's what happens, like Bert's saying. It's just a whole bunch of interesting, obscure facts, like the Venetian philosophers, Contarini, Zorchi, Paolo Sarpi. You don't even know who these names are. And what they did in helping Henry VIII become, start a new religion, the Protestant religion. And then how they promoted Galileo and Newton and dropped Leibniz. It's a great way to remember history. It's a good system.
Yes, it is.
You look at
it is.
Mathematical physics as a fucking spy versus spy syndrome. It's very interesting. Here's somebody says Myanmar. Isn't that like, so this would be OPH? Is that who just came in? OPH? Opinel? I think he's blipping out. Anyways, it says Myanmar. That's the new name for Singapore or something, isn't it?
Burma.
Where is that?
Myanmar, that's Burma.
Oh, okay, Burma. Well, that would be, this is probably Greg Allen, you know that guy, calls in the teacher in Burma.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's him, but he's not speaking yet, but my connection is going in and out. It's pretty bad, so I don't know. But Bert's there.
Hey, Bob, I'm going to be saying goodbye now. I'm starting to fade.
Well, it is for you. It is 6:25 in the morning.
5:26. I've been going here for 7 hours, so it's been a lot.
Fine effort, Greg.
My shift is over.
Yeah, fine effort, Greg. Very good. Is it 7 hours? It may be more. You came in at
around 9:45. I'm doing overtime.
Well, yeah, you came in at 9:45, and that's it's a 9:45, 2 hours, and then another seven hours. Yeah, that's pretty good.
Around 7 hours and 40 minutes. Yeah, I've done about 15 or 20 minutes of overtime here. So
yes, and Catherine hears none of it, right? She does not.
I hope not.
Why not?
Well, she's trying to sleep.
No, I mean before you go to sleep, she should come in, listen to you.
Well, she just comes in to say goodnight, and then she's been down. She was down watching television until about midnight, I guess.
That's a fucking vegetable, baby boomer fucking zombie life. Why doesn't she want to learn stuff? Because she's heard your stories 100 times, is that why?
I think so. You know, and then there's you. You know, that she.
She have a problem with me? What, she got a problem with me?
I don't think she has a problem with you. It's just that, I just don't like. She couldn't tolerate what we're doing here.
she would consider I encourage the worst parts of you.
Maybe
more angry.
I don't know.
Angry man on the radio.
I don't know what it'd be like. I don't know what it'd be like if she was actually involved, if she was speaking.
Oh, yeah, we asked her, took her opinion seriously.
Right, and then things would happen and people would be responding. I'm not sure how that would go. I think she doesn't even want to do that. I don't think she's never even brought that up. I think she just thinks, oh, this is a good thing for Greg to do because, you know, like, lets him get, you know, let off some steam and, you know, it'll calm him down and then, you know, or he, of course he's up late, I'd like him to get to sleep, but, yeah, but Mary was like that. It was like she thought, oh, you know, he has the radio program. It lets him just, you know, get all these terrible ideas he has out there. You know, and then she'd, you know, then she doesn't have to be dealing with them.
Yeah, because Greg must declare his devotion to the head of North Korea at least twice a week, and she had to put up with it before the radio show.
I remember when I was first with Mary, when I was first with Mary, and, you know, she's from a Chinese family, as I've mentioned. And, you know, I remember sitting with her in our first apartment. I started, I guess I was saying positive things about the People's Republic of China and Mao Zedong or something. She got really outraged.
Because she had just left there. She had defected.
No, she never lived there. Well, she wasn't from there. She was born in Canada and she'd spent time in Hong Kong, but and she got really offended, and she got over that, though. You know, I guess I was a
persuasive in the long run.
Persuasive factor. I mean, she got over that, and then she'd be more likely to talk about her father, who was from China proper. I don't think he'd ever lived in the People's Republic of China as it is after 1948, but. She started saying, oh, well, my father, well, he didn't mind the communists coming in. He preferred them to the others and things like that. So even though he was sort of maybe an elite person in the village that he came from and owned a mill or something like that. But I remember she was really incensed with me when I was stating
she was a capitalist Chinese. She had this normal image of China.
Well, I think that her mother, who was born in Canada and from missionary background, her relatives were missionaries. You know, they were basically traders in China, selling out to the Western influences. That's my view of it. Although her mother wasn't particularly religious, I never thought. She was very anti-communist in the sense that when they went back to live in Hong Kong for a brief period of time in the mid-50s, Mary's father suggested that he was going to go back into China to go visiting his family, and he was going to take Mary with him. Anyway, who would have been quite, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years old, and Mary's mother, who's a Canadian Chinese, so said, "Oh no, you know, you can't take her over there. They're going to kidnap her."
Mm.
And I said, I said to Mary, "You know, that wouldn't have happened. they wouldn't have appropriated children." I mean, so she was sort of believed she believed like most people believed in the sort of anti-communist rhetoric of the time,
right?
The Red Scare.
Okay, listen to this, Greg. We have on the line a guy who taught in China. I forget your name, Greg, Dave, Allen. It's been so long. What's your name?
Bob, this is Brian in Myanmar. Hello.
I don't remember you as Brian. That's funny. That didn't stick with me.
Well, yeah,
I know who you are. We've had many conversations, but I lost that name.
Yeah, but Bob, your memory is always warping, and you can't
remember
yesterday from tomorrow's today.
What?
So that's okay.
Well,
I don't expect...
My alibi is I pay such good attention that I'm listening to Greg. The whole life I've had with Greg is in my memories. And then to shift over to Burma is quite a radical shift. It's like going to another world. So that's my alibi why I can't forget at some point.
I understand, I mean, Bob. I forgive you. You have an excellent memory for detail, and if you forget whatever details about names, that's not important so much. But you know where I'm operating. I'm in Myanmar, and that's the important point. So,
yes, and didn't you teach in China?
I did. I spent over 4 years living in People's Republic of capitalism, and there. I speak Mandarin fairly well, so I can tell you about. I can comment about, you know, communist socialist brainwashing. I looked everywhere for real communists. I couldn't find any because they were making so much money.
Hey, Greg, hold it, Brian. I want to say something. Cause Greg's going. Hey, Greg.
Brian doesn't understand. It's socialism with Chinese characteristics, which are very much like capitalism.
Which is, okay. Yeah, with capitalism coating over a communist ice cream cone. Oh, I get it. Yeah, it's delicious.
And then there's the mountain. Greg, the mountain is the real financial power there in China. They're the elite, been around for thousands of years. So, Greg, before you go, I want you to realize, remember on your show we get Boogie from Scarborough calling in, and then some other idiot from downtown Parkdale, all the different parts of Toronto. You recognize who we have? We have a guy in Switzerland, a guy from Burma, last week Alyssa from Vietnam, and a few other I can't remember. Anyways, South Africa. Look at the range of audience I have compared to your puny CKLN fucking life.
No, you're right.
Yeah, you have to be impressed. You tell.
I mean, the only time that we had listeners, I believe, from outside the general area, was when you got involved in the program.
Yeah.
Then we started having people who were recording the show from somewhere in the United States and, you know, were posting it up before we got home, you know, from making it. And it is incredible, really, that you're having all of these people from so many countries.
We're the real global revolutionary force with ionness.
Yes.
We're the real global.
But you know what's even
because ion at work.
But what's interesting? What I find interesting though is, I mean, all right, so we get people from here and there and so on and so forth, but there are not many people from America.
Oh yes, there are. There's always there's a lot of Americans. But you've got Jean, Susanna, Sarah, and a few others I can't think of. There is a core of Americans on this.
Yes.
And then a lot more when I am
Madeline.
Here. Madeline. And a couple of whack jobs. Now, Corbin has disappeared. We don't know. I can't be bothered to call him up. I just call him up. Hey, where you been? But I don't want to have to listen to him for 2 hours. So I just sort of wonder, what happened to Corbin? Talk about lazy. See, I run a revolution, Greg, in the most lazy manner, and it's sort of like, but yeah, what's this, Wednesday? Oh, okay, yes, we have our revolution. We're going communist today, and then Friday we go capitalist. But yes, Greg, it is awesome, and you tell Mary, Catherine. That you're going out to the world on Bob's show. You're not going to a little inner sanctum someplace. This is the world. And then Ed Post, the international profiles who click on Ian and Bob. They're all over the fucking world. Italy, Portugal, it's pretty amazing what people who are clicking on regularly to our site.
Yeah.
It is. It is amazing, I have to say.
Yeah. And, of course, And what are they all bonded by? They take the magic juice. That's what holds us together.
Yeah.
They're all stone great.
Yeah, stuff. Everybody's high on RNA drops. It's true.
We had Akito. Akito listens, but he never calls in. Akito in Japan, when the famous earthquake happened, the purple thing in March 2011, the radiation came in and fucked up Tokyo, which he lives near, but his pathway to his house with flowers and plants prospered during the radioactivity because he was exhaling RNA drops, which thrives in radioactivity. So his house had all these wonderful gardenings, and everybody else was dying in the neighborhood. How's that, Greg? Oh.
Bad for the people that are dying, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, so Aikido, we got Japan. Okay, Greg, yep. Unless you want to say something to Burma about something.
I'd love to. I mean, it sounds I'd like to tap into what Brian knows and what he's seen. There's a Chinese woman, a young girl living next door, and speaks pretty good English, but to try to get to the bottom of what's going on there and thing about whether it's really, you know, the Marxism and the capitalism, I mean, it's a fascinating topic. I'd like to do it one day, really. I hope
okay.
we can.
Well, we'll get
but
Brian
I'm just
in.
A little too tired to do it tonight.
Yeah, it's just that Brian's not reliable. He hasn't been here in like 4 fucking months or more, you know. I don't know what holds Brian back. But, Brian, if you told me you definitely were coming in, then we'll get Greg on and you guys hash it out.
That sounds good, Bob.
For me.
It's a matter of coordinating my work schedule here with the timing. We're a day or 24 ahead of you whenever
right.
your show's broadcast. So we'll work it out. I do listen in and I follow up when I'm not calling in. I'm following and taking the drops and listening and paying attention. And then it's a matter of organizing the time to coordinate with you guys here.
We have Greg on once a month, so plan like in a month. That should give you time to coordinate which week within, and like in 4 weeks from now, you could do it. The fourth or fifth week, say, or sixth week from now, whenever. If you can figure
Greg,
it out.
I can tell you the Christmas holiday will be perfect timing for me here because I have a free slack time during the Christmas.
Okay, that'll be good for me too.
All right, we're going to schedule a Chinese symposium with a North Korean advocate, Greg something, forget his last name, and then we have from Burma or Myanmar, an expert from China, name is Brian, we don't know his last name. This is
Brian, did you ever think while you were in China, and I don't know where you were exactly in China, but did you ever think, oh, I've got to go over to the DPRK, I've got to go over to North Korea?
I was less than an hour from the border and talked with North Koreans in what's Jilin province in China. I was stationed there as well as Beijing, so, yeah. I didn't
Did
make it over
to
North
Korea.
Did you
ever want to go over?
I thought about it, but I talked with some North Koreans that were living in Jilin City where I was stationed at the time, and we had some interesting conversations in Mandarin.
So you can tell us about that.
Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah, that'd be great too. So we'll try and do that in the latter part of December then.
Yeah, when do you get off, Brian? What's the earliest? Because there'll probably be one Christmas day we won't do a show. Bill has to have the time off. So
I'm free after December 22nd. I'll be. Open times for me any day after 22nd.
Okay, so we would we probably tend towards the New Year's show, more closer to New Year's than Christmas. Does anybody have a calendar? Can they tell?
I've got a calendar. So the 22nd is a Saturday. So you're busy on that 22nd, right, Brian?
No, I'm free that day.
Are you?
I'll be free. Yeah.
Okay, then we'll do it then.
Yeah,
is
December
that okay?
22nd.
Is that okay?
Yeah,
I think so.
Yeah, 22. That's,
Bill, if
that's
you're
a
listening.
Good day for me and a good number.
Are you listening,
22.
Bill? I don't think he takes – I think he takes Christmas Day off, so that's not Christmas Day, so we'll be on.
Yeah, that's perfect for me, Bob. Yeah.
And that's for Club 22, December 22nd.
Yeah, I'm on 22.
Good number. Okay, Greg.
And I'm in town. I don't celebrate Christmas, so I'm here and –
Yeah, neither
and I'll
do
be
I,
available.
Right? None of us here celebrate Christmas.
Okay, good.
We're communists.
Good.
We're Marxists. We follow LaRouche.
With capitalist characteristics, right? We're Marxist.
Yeah. Yeah, we're all Chinese here. We're actually really Chinese. Black Chinese black guys. Chinese black women.
Right.
We have a new dimension here. All right, well, okay. We must carry on, Greg. So thank you very much for a wonderful show and a wonderful narrative about everything
thank
that you talked about.
Thank you
for tolerating
me. Take care.
Okay, good night.
Okay, good night.
Night.